Of course, as Justin mentioned, I'm at the Perimeter Institute. I have a second affiliation. Since I had my degree in astrophysics, I decided to start this. I'm the only member of it, though, but I accept they accept applications. Okay, good, good. Yeah. Well, maybe. Yeah, so we're gonna build this, and we're gonna get to 10-year process as well. Okay. So it's the story. I'm gonna tell you a little bit of a history about cartography, and how our horizon basically expanded through history from the time of ancient Greeks. Ptolemy, for example, made this map, or this described all the points in this map. Which is actually looks a little bit different, and he was missing parts of it. I guess he was missing all the parts like America. And the status in today's universe is very similar, although the scale is very different. So this is 10^9 centimeters, 150 AD from due to Ptolemy, and see if it comes through. And this is how it looks like today, a similar map of the universe, although at much larger scale, but the similar incompleteness. So this is a Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Every point in this map is a galaxy, and obviously we're flying through this map, artificially flying through the galaxy. Yes, that's one of the new discoveries, of course. The fact is that you can just stop here, and then that's much more romantic universe. But the fact is that there are many places in the universe that we're missing, especially farther distances, but also many places in the same distances just because we don't have enough time and resources. But hopefully, we're going to fill the gaps within the next decades or so, next few decades. But still, there is a lot missing. So it's very much similar to the early days of cartography on the Earth. And the fact is that this is actually the deepest map of the universe that we have. And there is a lot that is missing in the previous map. So this is essentially the age of the universe, the deepest map of the universe, which is 10 times deeper, and is done in microwaves. So this is when the photons of the microwave background last scattered from the plasma, intergalactic plasma, and travel to us straight, basically. So this is where the observable galaxies sit, and there is a whole universe 10 times larger that we basically know nothing about. At least physically we may know a lot, but observationally we haven't made maps of it. But then there is this surface where we have a maps of the one snapshot map of the universe, and this is as deep as it goes. So I guess this is cartography from Ptolemy to Tegmark. Now, our horizon through time, this is a slide that took most of my time. So this is how horizon expanded over time. So from 200 BC, most people don't know this, but actually Eratosthenes was the first guy who measured the radius of Earth, or the circumference of Earth, to 1% accuracy. And he did it just based on the angles of shadows from different places at midday in Egypt. So from Alexandria and another place in Egypt. So this is amazing that so long ago we knew Earth was spherical. And that's what motivated Columbus to travel the wrong way to go to India. Of course, he discovered America. Magellan finally completed the trip. But this is an interesting prediction, which was done first in 200 BC and finally confirmed by Magellan, I guess 18 centuries later. Now, the biggest scale that we probed next was the distance to Mars. So that's the expansion of our horizon from Earth to Mars, the solar system, 10 AU, which is around 5 orders of magnitude larger in the 17th century. Then we went to the nearest star, Both these were measured by parallaxes. This is parallax from different points on Earth, and measuring the distance to stars is parallax due to different points in the orbit of Earth in the solar system. And basically, the angle at which you see stuff changes. So you already, by 1838, have expanded your horizon by 10 orders of magnitude. 1920, Shapley was the first guy who, well, the most famous guy who actually argued for the presence of the galaxy on a scale of kiloparsecs. So that's almost 1,000 times larger than the distance of the nearest star. And the universe expanded from a bunch of the stars to a nylon universe with the size of that galaxy. And finally, Hubble in the 1930s confirmed that there are other galaxies that are about even 1,000 times larger. And this went on until this was the picture that gradually expanded. But significantly, in 1965, when Penzias and Wilson discovered the microwave background. And so that was basically, that's really as far as it goes. That's the farthest distance that we have been able to see. And it's now almost 20 orders of magnitude larger than what we did 22 centuries ago. And there is also indirect evidence that the actual inflationary horizon is at least 3 orders of magnitude larger than this, than what we observe today. But this is more indirect evidence. Basically, this is the scale over which the universe must be homogeneous for it to look so isotropic on our observable horizon. So this is the history of the horizon. And you see, anytime we try to find something beyond our observable horizon, we discover something new. From America to the galaxy, for example, to the Hubble expansion, and to the basically to the cosmology, cosmic microwave background. So this is a really rich branch of science, if you will. Although people don't count all this in the same branch, but in a way they are. So something else that's related to the horizon is also very important in the development of cosmology, so-called horizon problem. So this is a schematic space-time diagram. So here you have the Big Bang. At some point, you have the last scattering where photons start traveling freely to Earth. And this is 16 gigayears after the Big Bang, when you're observing them. And the thing is that the causal horizon at the last scattering is something small, if only a few degrees in the sky, if you look at the last scattering surface where the photons started traveling freely. But somehow this cosmic microwave background is isotropic to 1 part in 10 to the 5 over the whole sky. And the puzzle is how light couldn't travel fast enough to basically let this point and this point communicate, how come everything has the same temperature in the sky? So this is really a problem with causality. And it's known as the horizon problem. And was a big problem in cosmology until 20 years ago, or 25 years ago. Now, 25 years ago, Alan Guth came up with a solution, so-called inflation. So he suggested that a period of exponential expansion can actually inflate the causal horizon, this guy, to as big a scale as you want. So points that are really, really far apart can actually could have been in causal contact at some point in the early universe. So this was really the reason, the experimental evidence for inflation, or the experimental motivation for inflation, which led to this conjecture, an exponential expansion at some early time. And it turns out that 60 e-foldings of this exponential expansion could give you can solve a horizon problem. It also correctly predicts a flatness of the universe. The spatial curvature of the universe is very small, which is observationally true. As far as we know, there is no spatial curvature. And quantum perturbations perturbations give you nearly Gaussian linear fluctuations, which is observed as well. So the fluctuations in our universe in its initial conditions are Gaussian to a very good accuracy. So these are successful predictions of inflation. There are other model-dependent features or predictions of inflation, if you will. It's the non-Gaussianity, which can be large, or relatively mildly large in certain models. So at some point, you might be able to detect the fact that initial conditions didn't have Gaussian statistics. Or gravitational waves, that for certain models of inflation, where you have a high energy scale of the inflation, you can have detectable gravitational waves. However, something else, another less trivial prediction of inflation, or the so-called eternal inflation, is that if you have 60 e-foldings of exponential expansion, generically we think you could have many more e-foldings of exponential expansion. And this is subjective. So this is a controversial statement. But you can imagine if you have 60 e-foldings, you can start a lot. There are models that could give you many more e-foldings of inflation. If that's the case, then generically you have a self-similar nonlinear structure on super horizon, very large scales. And that's also a subjective statement, but that also you can imagine many theories that naturally lead to this as well. And this is a self-similar linear picture of the eternal inflation, where because of quantum fluctuations, certain regions never stop inflating, but other regions do stop inflating. We'll be sitting somewhere down here where energy density is low, but many regions are still inflating and have lots of quantum fluctuations. We don't see them within our horizon, but in principle, if there were many foldings of inflation, they should exist somewhere out there on the super horizon scale. So there is a lot that should be going on outside our horizon, even if you believe in the inflationary paradigm. So also I have to clarify something. There are different definitions of horizons. There is inflationary horizon, which is how far light travels since Big Bang. So it could be very large, much bigger than what we see today, as I was telling you. There is the Hubble horizon, which is basically 1/ Hubble constant, Hubble expansion rate. So it's important for linear perturbation theory. That's what quantifies evolution of, it enters the evolution of linear perturbations. And also there's today's Hubble horizon, which is C over the magnitude of Hubble constant today. And it's important because dark energy seems to be kicking in right around now. So this is also another interesting scale that may enter a lot of the theories. It turns out that often when people talk about horizon, they mean the Hubble horizon. Well, although it's not real horizon in any rigorous sense, that's what people use in their vocabulary these days. So you should beware. You shouldn't confuse these guys. Right? Just be sure you know what they're talking about. So with that introduction, here's what I'm going to tell you about. So I'm going to tell you about cosmic acceleration and the ISW effect. So that's the warm up for basically warm up to what comes around the horizon. About gravity on horizon scale, and about the statistics on horizon scale. And if I didn't say this, don't hesitate to interrupt me at any time. Okay. So this is another view of the cosmic history, another artist's conception. So this is the early times, Big Bang, inflation and quantum fluctuations. This is the cosmic microwave background that I was talking about, after which photons were traveling freely to reach us. For a long time, nothing happened, and at some point, the stars and galaxies started forming and evolving until today. Now, something interesting has happened that doesn't seem to fit anything else that is going on in the universe, at least not in any trivial way, is that at some point about 5 billion years ago, acceleration or expansion of the universe started accelerating. And this could be interpreted as evidence for a mysterious dark energy component, which should have a negative pressure. And there is no good understanding of why it is there. So people disagree that if it's too small or too big. But there is basically no understanding of what it is. An interesting phenomenological implication of this dark energy or accelerated expansion, however, is the so-called integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. So it turns out that when expansion of the universe starts accelerating, it results in decay of Newtonian potential. So if you have potential wells in the universe, if there was no dark energy or if there was no accelerated expansion, they would just stay constant. They would freeze. That's an interesting phenomenon in the matter era. But as soon as expansion starts accelerating, or dark energy basically starts dominating, these potentials start decaying. And the fact that potentials are changing with time, it causes the so-called integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, which is basically a change in the temperature of photons that travel through these potentials. It's proportional to the integral of phi dot dt along the line of sight. So say you have a structure here which causes a potential well. If you have a decaying gravitational potential, what happens is that photons that plunge in gain some energy, but then when they plunge out, when they come out, they don't lose all of that energy. As a result, they're hotter as they come out here. It's proportional to the integral of phi dot dt. So if phi was constant, these would exactly cancel each other. But since you have accelerated expansion, they don't. And this is a non-trivial effect. So the temperature photons that pass through a structure are different. So this leads to some effect in the power spectrum of cosmic microwave background. So these are observations, the most recent observations by WMAP. So this is the power spectrum of fluctuations in angular power spectrum of fluctuations as a function of L. And this is the prediction, the lines, that there is a small upturn at a small L's due to the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. And different models can give you different amounts of upturn. But the fact that there is dark energy domination means that there must be this effect. The reason it peaks on very small L's or very large scales is that potential seems to be very homogeneous at small scales and only fluctuates on very large scales.
The only change is on the width of the potential, not the breadth?
No, yeah, it doesn't. On linear scales, on larger scales, where perturbations are linear, the width doesn't change. It's just the amplitude that changes. Yeah, so. And that's an interesting, I think the reason for that is that the speed of sound is zero, essentially, very small in the matter era. So this is the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. However, you see the error bars are huge here. So there is, you cannot really see an real evidence for it in the power spectrum of microwave background. And the thing is that these error bars don't get any smaller. This is as good as it gets with the sky that you have. However, there is a way to extract these fluctuations, the ISW effect, out of all the fluctuations that you see in the CMB. So all of these are primary fluctuations on the last scattering surface. There is a small percentage of it, the ISW effect, that's generated on the way to us. Most of it were basically initial conditions of the universe at the last scattering surface. There is a way to get rid of those, though. If you look at the correlation between the map of the sky, the cosmic microwave background, and the map of the galaxies in the sky, since the primary fluctuations are much farther distances, as I showed you, are 10 times farther, they don't correlate with galaxies, but the ISW effect does. So a cross-correlation can actually extract the ISW signal, which is the signature of dark energy, from everything that's going on in the microwave background. And this is an example of it. This is the cross power spectrum of galaxies in two-mass survey with the WMAP. And you see that at low L's, which are small angles, sorry, large angles, there's a positive signal. At large L, something else happens. That's also interesting, but we're not going to talk about that. At small L, there is some slight evidence for a positive correlation, which is the signature of the ISW effect. That's what you expect. And this has been detected for many other surveys, which I'm going to show you later. So, and this is an independent evidence for dark energy. So there, we have many, many different lines of evidence for dark energy, but this is completely independent and actually rules out many alternative models that are contrived but don't predict this. In fact, this was part of the science's number one breakthrough of the year, which was the consistency of different observations as evidence for dark energy. Now, I may not agree with this being the number one breakthrough, but this is certainly interesting that everything fits in together so consistently. You see now, I never thought about it because I should go through a lot of things. cosmology is a good, the fact that there is cosmological convergence is a good thing. Absolutely. Let's see, what else I wanted to mention? So it's the fact, it wasn't only the data that I showed you. There are many different pieces of evidence, including that, and cross-correlation with other surveys that all were consistent with the same model.
Sorry? What extent would you establish with the W parameter for that energy?
This is a cosmological constant, so W is minus 1. And as far as we know, there is no evidence for anything otherwise. But that's a different talk.
And the question is how large are the error bars? But that's too special now, I guess.
Yeah. But the question is, what are the alternatives? And yes, so you can always think of alternatives that are very close, that are consistent with observations. But there were many models where people, I mean, for example, many people don't still believe that there is dark energy. There could be something else. And all those models are now very contrived. So, yes, so there, you can imagine models that are very close to this model. But historically, I guess, maybe in the past 10 to 20 years, there have been many different models that are now ruled out, basically, with this concordance, with this convergence. There is this single model with a cosmological constant that has survived all the tests so far. So, can you do any cosmology with the ISW effect? So as we just heard, it turns out that ISW effect is not a very good probe of W prime. It just happens to be the case that the ISW effect doesn't have that much statistical significance as it is. However, it does probe something as something different that might be interesting for many people, especially you guys in this room. If you look at where most of the statistical power of this signal to noise squared, where most of the statistical power of ISW comes from as a function of K, it peaks at a relatively large scale. And this is very model dependent. So you could have a model where this peak, there's the peak is even farther out. But even for a lambda CDM model, it peaks somewhere around K of 0.01. But all the galaxy surveys probe basically a larger case, that is, the smaller scales. They cannot really be trusted because of all kinds of systematics. You cannot really understand fluctuations or interpret cleanly fluctuations in galaxy surveys on larger scales. But ISW is a relatively clean probe of larger scale physics, which is insensitive to many systematics that galaxy surveys are sensitive to. So that's a cool thing. So that's a good probe for new physics close to the horizon scale. And I'm going to tell you a couple of examples of how it will be done, or it is done. Another interesting observation is that if you put together all detections of ISW effect as a function of redshift, you see that they are all slightly higher than prediction from lambda CDM model. So I was telling you the lambda CDM model is successful. So that means that it's consistent with all these, but it's kind of disconcerting that all these points are above the prediction. They are all consistent, but this is something at the level of 2 sigma discrepancy, if you know what I mean. So it's not that big enough to start worrying about, but at the same time, you worry why all of these are above, and some of them statistically should be below. So this is some effect or some lensing effect. So it's not important. So this is the real prediction, and it, there is some magnification bias that's going to change the prediction.
So I'm just going to look at a dark energy model.
This is lambda. So the thing is that there are so many other constraints on dark energy models, so they wouldn't be just crazy per se, but the fact that we have so good constraints from other cosmological observations, say CMB, distance to last scattering circle. So if you factor those in, then it's really hard. As far as I know, you cannot really get up here, get these things up. But of course, you don't have to go very up because the errors are small. But then really, you cannot change this curve. But like, you can change it at a few percent level only. Mm-hmm. So it's the only thing you cannot play the theory to make this consistent. You should play with these data points really, and when you don't really know how to do that.
So the instrument signal, since it's higher than the lambda CDM curve, does it mean we need W less than minus one in that
region? It actually means W larger than minus one. And it's not really one parameter that enters, because W tells you the evolution. But so that W less than minus one would be good for here, W larger than minus one would be good for here. Here it's not so obvious. So it is a puzzle, but I'm going to come back to this. But
sorry about the, you say another desk probe in it. So I just said it. So are people thinking instead of using optical surveys, instead of using galaxy correlations, like using weak lensing correlations with CMB, can you do that and probe a similar?
You can, absolutely. The thing is that weak lensing is much harder basically to get weak lensing. So you. It's harder to get weak lensing because you have to measure the shapes of galaxies very well on very large areas of the sky, which is been done really. So I mean, all weak lensing surveys on very small areas of the sky, and obviously for this kind of thing, you need the whole sky, such as anything meaningful. But that can be done in principle, and you can use CMB lensing. So the lensing can be done, but just much harder to do. Yeah.
Can I say?
Yeah.
Naively, what would you if you wanted the model to fit better, would you ask potential wells to change in time faster, something like that?
Something like that. Yes. So you don't want to change the geometry very much because that's already constrained. But you want the potential wells to behave differently. So. And since usually these two go hand in hand, it's not difficult. It's not easy to do that, make this happen. Keep one fix and change the other. So if you change cosmology, you usually change both the expansion history and the fluctuation. So I should mention these two maps is what I was telling you. I should show you. So this is at my results, by our results, and this is I will also involve with the CSS analysis. So now, what can the ISW actually tell us? So this is an example of what could change ISW in an acceptable kind of way. So if you have, you know about Newtonian gravity, of course, since four centuries ago. There is a very similar equation, the Friedmann equation, which expresses the expansion of the universe. And it turns out that in Einstein's theory of gravity, there's the same constant sitting in both these equations. But you could imagine in some general theory of gravity, and of course we know that we don't know gravity as well as we should because of so many reasons, these don't have to be the same. Sorry?
Forget about
dark energy. So let's say you have your lambda or whatever you have in your. Let's say you have a W minus one.
From that we brush it down in this equation.
It's just you wrote the free equation.
Let's see. Did I write it? Yes, there is. That's right. There is rho. This is rho plus 3p. Yeah. Right.
So then you should call it ratio of order.
Ah, really? Okay. Well, I won't call both of them Friedmann equation. But yeah, you're right, Richard. So in a matter of yes, so this is rho plus 3p. Right.
Yeah.
So there is a pressure, absolutely. Okay, so there is a pressure. Yeah. just to the paper. Thank you. So these are two equations, but let's say what happens if GF and G Newton, G Friedman and G Newton aren't the same. So this could be interpreted as Planck mass running on the cosmological horizon scale. So what happens, or can you have a Planck mass that's not a constant of the theory as it is in Einstein's gravity, but something that is an effective, is a coupling constant, which it is really is, and is a scale dependent. In fact, there are theories that predict that. The first and the third one are scalar field theories. So if you have a scalar field with exponential potential, so that's very simple. And it effectively, if you look at gravitational matter or forces, you see that gravity is masked or dressed on super horizon scales, but on sub horizon, on a smaller scale, gravity isn't dressed. And that causes a Browning in the Planck mass. If you have a Lorentz violating fixed norm vector field, you get the same effect, different G's on super horizon and sub horizon scales. And there is another model that we came up, so-called Coskuton model, that gives you exact same thing. Your Planck mass is different than super horizon and sub horizon scales. And this is how it would look like. Yes.
The chameleon model, would you say that was an example of
instance? Is it? Where? I don't think it is.
I was thinking if the plug where you feel fires is tied to the mass, so GN's fixed. Could it be globally changed?
Yeah, there's a way you can think of chameleon as one of those crazy Cartesian stuff.
But you see, any scalar field model really does something like this, because on super horizon scales, a scalar field fluctuation dress your gravity, but on sub horizon scales, they decay and they you don't see the bare gravitational constant.
But you still have to have something. It's not that simple, right? You still have to have something that freezes the scalar field.
You mean like initial conditions or no?
You have to avoid the pitfalls of scale.
Yeah.
Something that scale degree of freedom at short scales, which the chameleon does
these theories that I'm talking about don't have any feature on sub horizon scale, so they look exactly like Newtonian gravity on sub horizon scale, basically. Like chameleon is designed to have features on a small scale.
If you have a scalar, if it's not chameleon, surely it's not just.
No, you're not. Okay, so all of these are calculated in the context of Einstein gravity. It's just that you have some extra degree of freedom.
If you have an extra thing, you have rho dark energy, which you think of as part of the.
Yes, that's one way to think about it. Yes, that's right. So the fact that you don't know your total rho, you have some rho of a scalar field that you don't know about, so you would think of it as some modification of G.
But why would I think that?
Because you don't know what you don't know about this.
I know G Newton here, and I usually assume it's the same. Why would I fool myself?
But if you don't know about this extra component, then you write your Einstein equations, you find that M Planck is not constant anymore. So this is M Planck that you get from Einstein equation that doesn't have that extra term in it. So if you solve Einstein equation and plug it into an Einstein equation which doesn't have an extra component, you get the scale dependent Planck. So that's really the way to think about it. Which is
but the first case must be ruled out.
It depends on what are the parameters.
Unless you have something killing the effect of the scale
on a small scale? Well, this is not good essence.
You're not coupling it to matter.
You're not coupling it to matter. So these are all minimally coupled.
You're just redefining what you mean by G Newton. We're in like.
If you don't know what your model is, then you can look at it. But if you know, you can forget about writing it. It's not G Newton.
Yeah.
No, but I don't know how you do that. Because if GF is.
It's sort of the GF's function of the scale.
Yes.
Right? So you're in Jordan frame.
Yeah. I'm not in any particular frame when I say it. So my point.
You are. The Einstein frame is that defined as the frame in which G Newton is constant.
I don't think that's the right language, because there G is just the function of the space. And here I'm talking.
So here you're trying to think about what you're doing. You're saying just look at that equation. Normally it would be in the first example with the distance type thing, you would have 1/2 pi dot squared plus blah blah blah.
That's right.
And then you say, I'm going to absorb this as the definition of G Newton.
Exactly.
Pi dot is evolving on cosmological scales. That rescales G Newton.
Exactly. So for cosmological scales,
G Newton. It's not running locally, it's not having a time derivative locally.
That depends on the model. Model, I
think.
So it's just that fluctuations in those, for example,
fluctuations of that scale.
Yeah, scalar field on superhomogeneous scales are basically are present, but when they enter the horizon, they dissipate. So here you do see them, here you don't see them, so they affect their, here they do affect your gravity, here they don't affect. So that's why there is a difference.
Is the first one, is it like a tracker thing? Is that what you're saying?
It is. Yes.
That's okay.
I thought it was. Yeah, no, all of these are minimal traffic. So
the fact is that if there is a difference between those effective Planck masses on large and small scales, for example, if G Friedmann is larger than G Newton, it turns out that phi decays during matter era. Although it would remain constant if these were the same, now it decays, which causes two things. It causes early ISW effect, as I was telling you, which boosts the CMB power spectrum. That's this one. So as you add, as you increase this mismatch, you see that the CMB power spectrum goes up. While since phi is smaller, the structure formation is actually suppressed. So if you look at matter power spectrum, you see less power. With some fixed initial condition, of course. So there are two effects of opposite direction. The CMB power spectrum is boosted, but the matter power spectrum is suppressed. So that's why you can actually put very strict constraints on such a mismatch, which is about a percent, basically. So the G Friedmann and G Newton should be the same within a percent.
I don't
understand that. So that includes
you're
assuming compared to lambda
C cameras. So this has nothing to do with it. So I assume there's a lambda.
So the constraint on W,
maybe I'm missing. I assume W is -1. Okay.
Yeah, well, you just made some assumption about
what
GF is a function of
GF. Yeah, so this is with some particular model. But so let's say.
I know that the equation of state of dark energy is constrained to 10%. So
yeah.
Our example of your fracking potential, the first case, I would expect.
But that's assuming a constant W, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
so I could read off the particular GF, and you're trading in some sense, at least for a class of model, you're trading dark energy for a time dependent GF that you call it. So
you
I know,
say
I know
that's
for
right.
The fact that W being -0.9 is consistent with the data.
Yes.
So it should translate for some particular GF to a 10%.
So but you see, there is a difference here.
Yeah,
I mean, for example,
so
change of W, so this, the key phrase here is constant W for constant induction. A W sort of parameterization for dark energy doesn't affect CMB at all. I mean, it does change the distance to this last scattering surface, but other than that, it doesn't change.
So what you're saying is. Because essentially, if you take GF, you probably take GF to be independent of redshift. So that's like saying
exactly.
There's some dark energy component, which was 1% of the energy
exactly.
density all the way.
So this is not an early dark energy model. This is exactly like an early dark energy model. So the constraints that you put on W is very different from constraints that you put on an early dark energy model. And these are much stricter because you have a large evolution, large path length from CMB to today. Okay, so this is one constraint I promised you about the gravity on horizons.
So why does phi decay?
Meaning about theory, why?
So the thing is that, so you have expansion of the universe that obeys G Friedman, and you have a structure formation that obeys the Newton. So if G Friedman is larger, the expansion is faster. Basically, if you keep G Newton the same, but you increase G Friedman, the expansion becomes faster.
Does that require G have to be increasing or just
it's constant. Both are constant.
The ratio is constant.
It's like having a dark early dark energy, especially
like it's exactly like having a dark
energy. There's always a dark energy component even through the matter era, which in
so basically universe is expanding faster than you expected, so the structure formation is suppressed. That's what happens. So if these two were the same, the structure formation was just as fast as the that it would cancel the effect of expansion of the universe so that phi would remain constant. If you increase here, this expansion becomes faster, so the structure formation is suppressed. Okay. So this is gravity on supervised inertia. I understand that people think about modification of gravity in very different ways, but I think this is one very simple phenomenological way of thinking about it. It may not be the best or most interesting, but I think at the end of the day, that's a subjective matter. That what you think is a more motivated modification of gravity. But anyway, let's move on to the statistics on the horizon scale. So many inflationary models, basically all inflationary models, typically generate a non-Gaussian modulation of the metric perturbation. So they basically play with inflation changes the metric perturbation. That's usually how it works. But the size of this non-Gaussian contribution or non-linear contribution could be very small for some inflationary models. But this is basically the kind of expression with some qualifiers. This is the kind of non-Gaussianity that you expect. That the actual phi, the actual Newtonian potential, for example, on larger scales, is some Gaussian field plus FNL, which is a constant by definition, times some Gaussian field squared. In some sense, it's a parameterization, but it's a convenient parameterization because FNL tends to be very basically almost scale independent in inflationary models. The interesting feature about this kind of coupling is, which I guess it was kind of generic for non-Gaussian fluctuations, this introduces mode-mode coupling. In particular, at larger scale modes, if you have a larger scale mode, it modulates the statistics of the smaller scale mode. So this is basically the same expression if you decompose it to the smaller scale and larger scale mode. And I guess I'm ignoring some terms that aren't important. But the amplitude of your small scale mode is the amplitude of your Gaussian field times something, a factor that's modulated by the larger scale mode. So the statistics on a small scale, for example, the statistics of galaxies, if you have this nonlinear term, could probe modes on the horizon scale because of this modulation, because of this mode-mode coupling. Right? So even if you look at the small things, it could tell you something through this modulation about very large scale modes and this FNL parameter in particular. So this FNL is the parameter people use often to parameterize the non-Gaussianity of the initial conditions. Yes?
Mode coupling, of course, occurs just because of nonlinearity.
That's right, absolutely.
But this is an extra.
Oh, you mean nonlinear evolution today?
Right.
So this is an extra. So this is just in the initial conditions. And of course, subsequent evolution causes more mode-mode coupling, but that has a different form, and that happens late in the history of the universe when you have nonlinear structures. So every time that everything is linear, this is the only kind of mode-mode coupling that you get. Sorry. Okay. So that's interesting. Let's hold this thought. It's amazing that while this is these are obvious statements, people haven't thought about this in this context, basically. Think about it as modulating the statistics of galaxies on a larger scale until very recently. While this is really an obvious statement, and it could have dramatic consequences. Yes.
So this statement sounds very non-local.
This one?
Oh, the previous one.
No. So the first equation is the local equation.
Yes.
But then you're sort of writing quite a non-local equation.
Yeah, so because a small, large decomposition is non-local, and I haven't exactly defined it, but let's say that you decompose your fluctuations into a small scale and large scale fluctuations.
Mm-hmm. Is that the Fourier transform in a sense, loosely speaking, of the first equation?
Yes. That's right.
Yeah, but the question is there some sort of correlation?
Simply speaking, it will be a folding then, right? It makes that coming.
Here? Well, I mean, this is just a linear sum. So phi is phi s cross phi l. And this is a straightforward from here. I think I'm ignoring. Do I ignore something? No, I think maybe there is some phi square term that I'm ignoring here for now. But no, this is from here to here is straightforward. You got the only question is how you define phi s.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And that involves Fourier transform. You have some high pass filter that gives you phi s and low pass, and everything else is phi l.
So normally when you do that kind of thing, though, like phi s times phi l, will be small because, you know, when you go into Fourier space, there's some correlation function between the two.
Yeah, but that's, well, on average it would be small, but in the visual realizations, it could be significant. So this is interesting, and this has been recently realized, very recently realized by Dallal et al. The fact that on larger scales, if you have primordial non-Gaussianity, Galaxy distribution follows the Newtonian potential, actually, rather than density, which has been the assumption in every analysis that people have done so far. And the reason that this happens on larger scales is that your statistics that control the formation of collapsed objects is controlled by Newtonian potential through this term. And when you modulate your statistics, you generate perturbations in density. And it turns out this yields much bigger power on larger scale because potential, as I was telling you, potential fluctuations are much larger on larger scales than density fluctuations. And this is an example of the cross power spectrum that I was showing you before. This is between NVSS galaxy surveys and the WMAP CMB survey. The dotted line is a prediction from Gaussian ISW signal, what I had been doing and everybody has been doing so far. But if you add this non-Gaussianity with an FNL of about 100, then you don't change things on large L's on a small scale very much. But on a small L's that are larger scale, you get much, much bigger power in your galaxy distribution. And so that means that a much bigger power in the cross power spectrum between galaxies and the CMB. And the points are also very recent data from Ho et al. That, as I was telling you, they are all systematically higher, or most of the data seem to be systematically higher than the theoretical prediction from Gaussian field, from Gaussian theory. So this best fit actually consistent with FNL of 240 plus or minus 120. So it's about 2 sigma evidence, you could say. I bet Andrew didn't know he was on this paper. in fact, that's very interesting. However, unfortunately, about a month ago, or 2 months ago, Yarlath and Randall also got the number, which is, I guess, about 3 sigma, which is very similar to that. They are consistent, very, very close to each other within the error, from purely CMB, from WMAP to some large L, without any, only using CMB data. Eventually, you would think Planck satellites would get delta FNL about 5. And within 3 to 5 years from now. Of course, there are lots of systematics that you have to worry about before getting down there. And there could even be systematics involved in this that people haven't included. Obviously, there are things that you can obviously think of that haven't people thought about rigorously. This is the best accuracy for the method that I was telling you about. If you cross-correlate galaxies with basically large-scale structure with CMB, you can get signal to noise for detection of an FNL, which would look like this. So say if you have a redshift out to redshift survey out to redshift of 2, then this is the signal to noise of detection of different FNLs. So if FNL was 200 or say 100 these guys claim, then you would expect to eventually detect it at around 4 sigma with this method. Of course, it hasn't been done yet, but eventually you hope to do it around 4 sigma if you have a large enough redshift survey. And this is a very promising method in the sense that it's insensitive to systematics of individual surveys, because you're cross-correlating a CMB survey and a galaxy survey with very different systematics involved. The alternative would be to use just larger scale surveys, just galaxy surveys. They also would show large power on larger scales. However, that would be an indication of non-Gaussianity if there were no systematics. And all these surveys are dominated by systematics on very large scales, because you have a small real fluctuation and lots of atmosphere and every kind of thing you can think of that happens on larger scales. So these may be competitive eventually. But who knows? So, conclusions. So I told you about gravity on horizon scale and statistics on horizon scale. Now, so this is also another claim of mine, that our knowledge or intellect has often thrived through exploring beyond our horizons, and cosmology is no exception. So inflationary paradigm predicts a richer structure beyond horizon, so there is good motivation to invest in this investigation. And I told you about ISW effect. How it can probe new physics close to the horizon. And two examples. One is it can severely constrain the running of the Planck mass to less than 1% on the horizon scale. And in correlation with galaxy surveys, it can probe primordial non-Gaussianity, and there's tentative evidence for it at 2 sigma level. Now, physics on the horizon, so what's to come? You're gonna have large scale structure surveys, large synoptic survey telescope. You're going to have PanaStar, these are big surveys, like 10 times or even more stronger than SDSS. You're going to have JDEM, which probes lensing and on very large scales. George Dark Energy Mission, also with constraints on dark energy. And SKA, that's maybe 20 years from now, who knows. Both of these could give you significantly better detections of the ISW effect or primordial non-Gaussianity or any new physics that you can think may kick in around the horizon. There are CMB surveys, WMAP, you will have more data releases of WMAP, so better constraints on non-Gaussianity or possibly firmer detections of non-Gaussianity. And Planck will go up, well, I don't know, within a year and should have results within the next 3 or 5 years. And that gives you better constraints, for example, on the running of Planck mass that I was telling you about, because you can measure the early ISW effect more accurately. And there are also SD cluster surveys, which are another passion of mine that I didn't tell you about. So Atacama Cosmology Telescope, South Pole Telescope. Again, Planck will detect lots of clusters through the SD effect, which is a powerful way of finding big clusters in the universe. And hope it's another wishful thinking that larger scale statistics of these clusters will also teach you about primordial non-Gaussianity. But of course, how well this can be done, that's something that remains to be worked out. Thank you.
I didn't see the efforts anymore later on, but when you link large and small scales, focus on linearity, somehow the number of efforts should still enter.
It would enter this parameter, the FNL parameter in principle, but that's really a model dependent way. So let me
Here, yeah, so the FNL parameter of this definition, if I can find it somewhere, this is where it was. So the, this FNL parameter, in principle, if you have a large number of infold bits, you can basically capture some part of FNL into the normalization of IG. So there could be some sort of normalization depending on the scale that you're observing things at. But yeah, so if you have lots of infolding, it's going to affect your Gaussian perturbation and your non-Gaussian perturbations. But this is a good approximation, at least with a limited number of infoldings to describe both. But I mean, it turns out that I think if you have bigger boxes, then you can take part of it, put it in here, not otherwise. But yeah, but so if you have a particular model infolding, enter into this FNL, value of FNL.
Yes. I've got the same question because I didn't understand it. But the thing with GF and GN, I mean, if the two are constant, why? So, but GF's different. Why can't I just think of that as renormalizing the total matter? In which case, it wouldn't really affect.
Well, but you cannot because there's the homogeneous part and there are fluctuations in delta rho, and you cannot. I mean, if you want to renormalize both with the same factor, then you cannot do it. So you should renormalize the two.
No, I'm just saying renormalizing the total matter, but leaving. So I'm sorry, saying renormalize rho, but not delta rho.
But like that, you cannot do because there are. I mean, I don't really know what that means because.
Delta rho to rho letters, and you would just pick the same thing. You didn't say regressive, you would have been delta rho over.
Yeah, but then you're just rescaling by constant.
But I don't really know what that means because. So let's say you have N particles in the universe. So rho is the density of particles times mass, and delta rho is or delta n of particles times mass. And you want to normalize mass of the particle because n of course is defined is you cannot normalize n because the number density, right?
No, I'm just saying if GF only picks n. Super Hubble scale, variety scale, then why is it not just like renormalizing Omega matter?
Yeah, for the Friedman equation, that's true. But if you want to.
For a perturbation, then we're expecting it would be degenerate with change in sigma 8 or something.
No, it couldn't. I mean, so obviously it's not.
That constraint? Are you marginalizing over all of
it? Yeah, the thing is that. As I was saying, you find decays during matter error if you have this thing. So sigma is, and that would be normalization.
So I don't understand that. So if you're just changing GF by a constant, then during the matter error, the equation of state is still zero. This thing has the same equation. So why would phi have a different behavior as a function of
state? Do you want to think this as a dark energy model, or do you want to think it as a modified gravity model?
I'm just following your description. If GF is a constant,
okay,
then the evolution of the scale factor still goes as, you know, t to the 2/3, and so the growing mode of phi will still be the usual one.
No, that's not true. Because so this is basically, these are the equations you should be solving. So this is perturbation equation. I think it's 4 pi t, you know, times alpha. And this is g from, this is a Newton g. Because this is just a Newtonian equation, right? But then h comes from Friedman equation and has a Friedman Newton's constant in it. So if you plug in here from this, plug for h from this equation, then you have two different g's.
A g's a constant.
Yeah, there's a constant, but it changes the scaling. So basically, the solution would have been delta goes as t to the 2/3, but if these two aren't the same, then the solution is going to be modified. So it's got 2/3 times g Friedman divided by g Newton.
I don't understand.
Is
I just,
the
better way to think about it is not just, don't think about this as changing g. Think of this as a track for dark energy model where dark energy. Where the dark energy over matter is fixed,
throughout the background.
But that, I don't see how that would change the behavior of the Newtonian, but I still don't understand how that changed the behavior of the Newtonian.
Well, the same reason, it's the same reason why the Newtonian, why you see ISW today. Whenever you have any, whenever you have a component of dark energy,
yeah,
that means that the collapse due to gravity is not exactly. In matter domination, there's a special thing that happens where the collapse due to gravity and the expansion of the universe are sort of are both covered by the same thing,
oh,
so they cancel.
Okay.
But if there's a little bit of dark energy,
the background wins by a little bit over
exactly.
The one that desired collapse.
That's not
right. All right. So
sure.
So if I try to just redefine delta by a constant, so let's suppose GN is.
But let's just combine these two guys, okay?
Now, before we do that, I'm
okay.
Curious to know what you're doing. So, if I might think about sigma A, right?
Mm-hmm.
Suppose I just redefine initial delta by some small amount. So
sure.
Now it's GF times delta that
mm-hmm.
appears in the same.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. It seems to generate.
No, but the equation will be different. The equation will be different. So the initial condition might be the same, but the equation is different. So, the solution, this equation has a different solution now. If you plot from rho from this equation up here, you get delta double dot plus 2h delta dot equals 3gn divided by gf times delta. Okay. And I said there's an h square.
Because it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you already know what H is. H is, you, as you said, this is just a little one. You still have the same solution to Friedmann equation. H is 2 divided by 3t. So if you can just plug in from here, but this coefficient is different. This is not the same differential equation, so it has a different solution. All right? So you can express it right. It's delta double dot plus 4 divided by 3t. Times delta is 3, 4 divided by 3 times this factor gn divided by gf times delta. So there's a t squared. Okay. So this has a different solution. So that's, which is, as I said, delta doesn't grow as t to the 2 thirds, it's called the delta t to the 2 thirds times this.
So in getting this first equation, what you really get is an equation for delta rho, and then we usually play around with it to make it delta.
Yes.
Rho.
Yes.
But in doing that, you usually use the background.
No, no, no. This is just based on continuity equation, which is divergence of B equals minus delta dot, and the Newtonian equation minus B dot is so B dot is minus grad phi. And I guess on Poisson equation, which is Laplacian of phi, is 4 pi g rho, delta rho. And here I'm assuming this is g Newton. So, but these are all Newtonian equations. There's no reference to background here.
Well, there has to be some reference to the equation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, but the only common kinematic, you're
yeah.
right. So I think it's like minus 2. Which delta or something like that. Yeah. No, sorry, it doesn't come in here. It comes
still,
in here.
If you work in
minus HP.
Yeah,
if you work in conformal time, though, I mean, H always has the same. The point is, H has the same. Is the same.
It has. Okay. It's even now it's the same, so it has the same time dependence. Yeah. But this equation is different now because when you're plugging. Because this is different.
Right, but then that's the rescaling of the world.
Well, it's not. So you see this.
Andrew, again, I think that if you think of it, instead of doing all this, you just put in the Friedmann equation, h squared equals 4/3 pi g newton times rho plus rho dark energy, and put in an equation of state of minus 1 in a component that's always 10% of the total of the critical density at every time, and you're gonna then h is no longer gonna be 2/3. With some other solution, it's going to reproduce exactly.
Yeah, so but Mark is saying that this is the same as G Newton, but then you add another component to rho, which is some alpha times rho. This is dark energy, for example, some form of dark energy. And this would exactly look like rescaling G, which that's my preference. You can just say G Friedmann is 1 plus alpha times G. Yes.
Sorry, I have to confess, this confuses me at a fundamental level, because both the equation for the gravitational potential which you wrote about, which contains G Newton,
yes,
and the Friedman equation, both uh-huh. come from the Einstein equation, which contains only one Newton constant.
That's right, but I call this modified gravity, so the Einstein equation is not varied. So I'm pretending that this is I'm measuring the deviations from Einstein equation. But really, okay. So the point is that you have, let's say that you have an extra component in the energy density, in the energy momentum density of the universe. You could either consider it, put it on the right hand side of Einstein equation and call it dark energy, or put it on the left hand side and call it modified gravity. And here I'm putting it on the left hand side. Right?
But also, I mean, these are at different scale. Right? What you call G Newton is somehow G measured at a given scale versus, you know, G.
Yeah, that's
at
right.
Scale. And, mm-hmm. and in some sense, you know, in gravity, to some, you know.
I would say the Einstein equation doesn't hold about scale.
No, it's not.
I think
you take electrodynamics, you have a running of a constant, and then you know that depending on. You know, effectively, it's not really what's happening in the grid, but effectively, depending on, you know, how you
so,
I'm
saying that there are.
Of course, for gravity, you don't really, you know.
So there could be other.
Much more complicated than that, but.
Yeah.
It's an effective description.
Yeah, but in some sense, you are saying that the Einstein equation are different. Why is that your problem?
They
seem to be failing at the dark energy.
So that's another way of thinking about this. Even dark energy should be
embraced.
Yeah. So anyway, so I thought this was a more convenient way of thinking. But obviously not. If you always think about dark energy, this is not very convenient. But for non-cosmologists, I think this is a bit easier way of thinking about it. Very dark energy,
yes.
Yeah.
But,
yes.
So if you just do it with the scale of field, I mean, you would also at small scales and then you can worry about it for making sure.
But which is compressed basically because of the speed of sound of this one.
I mean, I guess what's like sort of worried me is, you know.
So there would be a delta rho of the scalar field, but it's very small.
You can always.
The unit is one, but it depends how you measure it. So.
Yeah,
we should talk about this. Okay, thank you. I appreciate any feedback in writing or in person. Or clapping.
Thank you.